It's intronarration. Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a giant in a small package, Ernest Hemingway's 1952 novella, The Old Man and the Sea. It seems almost deceptively simple, right?
Absolutely. Just over 27,000 words.
Yeah, but our mission today is to sort of figure out how this slender story ended up being this huge capstone to a Nobel Prize-winning career.
And that's really the magic, isn't it? To get the way of this book, you first have to understand Hemingway himself. I mean, a towering figure in 20th century literature.
Part of that lost generation?
Exactly. Shaped by World War I, by all those experiences, the fishing, the hunting, the wars. It all feeds into his writing style.
And that style. It's famous for the iceberg theory. It looks so spare, almost journalistic. Let's unpack that a bit for listeners who might know the term, but not, you know, what it really means for the reader.
Right.
It demands that you, the reader, do some work. The idea is that maybe only an eighth of the story's real meaning, its emotional core, is actually on the page, like an iceberg's tip.
So the rest is submerged.
Precisely. The deep stuff, the philosophy, the emotion that lies beneath, you have to infer it from what Hemingway doesn't say, from the simple dialogue, the clean descriptions. The subtext is everything.
And that must be why this book was such a massive success. It was a huge comeback for him, wasn't it? After some years where critics were a bit iffy.
Oh, definitely. It landed like a thunderclap. Sold over 5 million copies when Life magazine published it in just 2 days.
Wow. 2 days.
Yeah. Then the Pulitzer in 53 and the Nobel Prize Committee explicitly mentioned it in 54. It just perfectly distilled those themes he'd wrestled with his whole life. Courage, dignity.
It proved you didn't need flowery language to say something profound.
You just needed the right words.
Yeah.
Precision.
Okay, so let's dive into the story itself. Let's ground ourselves. Where are we?
We're in a small fishing village near Havana, Cuba. Feels kind of timeless, late 1940s maybe. And it all centers on Santiago. He's an old fisherman.
And the description of him is striking, isn't it? The contrast.
It really is. The source material emphasizes this. Mm-hmm. His body is frail, scarred from years of hard work, weathered. But then his eyes.
Ah, yes, the eyes.
They're the same color as the sea, and we're cheerful and undefeated. So physically, he's declining, but his spirit, still incredibly strong, undimmed.
But he's facing a really tough reality. He's hit a bad streak.
A terrible streak. Okay. 84 days without catching a fish. The locals call it salao.
Salao, which is
the worst form of unlucky. Just devastating for a fisherman. It's a crisis, professionally and personally. Nearly 3 months of failure.
But there's a bright spot, right? The boy, Manolin.
Yes, Manolin. He's the emotional anchor here. His parents have made him go fish on a lucky boat, but his loyalty to Santiago is fierce. He still brings him food, coffee, bait.
And hope, maybe.
And hope. Definitely. Companionship. He's the one who believes in Santiago, who listens to his stories. He's like the keeper of the old man's legacy, even before the big struggle begins.
So that sets the stage. And our deep dive mission here is to see how this simple setup becomes about so much more than just fishing.
Exactly. On the surface, sure, it's man versus nature, Santiago against this giant fish.
Underneath,
it's all internal. It's a test of his endurance, yes, but also his spirit, his identity. Hemingway's asking us, and Santiago is living away. The question is success, about the prize you bring home? Or is it about how you conduct yourself during the fight, the dignity you maintain?
It feels like a story about aging, too, about facing your limits.
Absolutely. Mortality, aging, what defines your worth when your physical strength starts to fade? Big questions.
So Santiago decides he has to break the salao. He makes a choice.
A big one. He decides to go out way farther than usual, out into the deep Gulf Stream, beyond where anyone else fishes. He's deliberately seeking a bigger challenge. He needs to prove something.
He's pushing his boundaries.
Pushing everything. And that's where the 3-day ordeal begins. Day one. He hooks something.
The big one.
The biggest. Around noon, the line goes taut. It's a massive marlin, bigger than any he's seen. But it's too strong. It starts towing the skiff.
So the fish is in control now.
Completely. Pulling him further and further out. It's this incredible stalemate. Painful, grueling, the ropes cutting his hands, his back.
And this is where he starts thinking about Joe DiMaggio, right? The baseball player. Why him?
DiMaggio is crucial. He's a symbol of grace under pressure, of performing perfectly despite injury, the bone spur he famously had.
Ah, okay. So when Santiago's own body is failing.
He thinks of DiMaggio. He draws strength from that image of persistence, of enduring pain for the sake of the game, or in his case, the catch. It's not about praying for it to be easy. It's about finding the will to endure. It grounds Santiago's almost mythic struggle in something real, something relatable.
Okay, day two. The suffering gets worse.
Much worse. The pain is intense. He's hungry, tired. His left hand cramps up, becomes this useless claw, as he calls it. He's utterly alone out there.
That isolation must be terrifying.
It is, but something interesting happens. He starts talking to the marlin. He develops this strange kinship with the fish.
Kinship? With the creature he's trying to kill?
Exactly. He calls it his brother. He respects its nobility, its strength, its dignity. He sees it as an equal. It's this incredible paradox, the respect and love mixed with the need to conquer. It speaks volumes about nature, about the hunter and the hunted.
And he keeps himself going by remembering things.
Yes, his memories become fuel. He recalls this epic arm wrestling match in Cienfuegos from his youth. Apparently it lasted a whole day and night.
Wow.
It's a reminder to himself and to us of his inherent strength, not just physical strength, but deep down resolve. That his battle isn't just with the fish, it's with his own aging body, his own limits.
He has to prove he still has that resolve.
He has to. The Cienfuegos match is proof he can endure. It's about sheer will.
So, day three, this must be the climax of the fight.
It is. The marlin finally starts to circle. It's tiring. This is Santiago's chance. He gathers every last bit of strength he has left.
The final push.
He pulls the marlin close, raises the harpoon, and drives it into the fish's heart.
Mm.
A moment of, well, supreme effort and skill. He's done it. He's won.
The physical battle is over.
And the prize is unbelievable. The marlin is 18 feet long, too big for the boat.
18 feet? So what does he do?
He has to lash it to the side of the skiff, this magnificent creature. He sets sail for home, feeling this moment of, you know, fleeting triumph.
Fleeting.
Yeah, because this is where the story pivots, really brutally. The victory is almost immediately challenged.
Okay, so the journey home isn't going to be smooth sailing.
Far from it. The marlin's blood leaves a trail in the water, and the sharks arrive.
Ah, the sharks.
The first is a mucko. A powerful, noble predator in its own way. Santiago kills it, but he loses his harpoon doing it.
Losing the harpoon, that's bad.
That's very bad. Because then come the others. The galanos, the shovel-nosed sharks. These aren't noble fighters.
They're just scavengers.
Exactly. They arrive in packs, and they start tearing chunks out of the marlin. The fight changes completely. It's no longer about skill against skill, strength against strength.
What is it about, then?
It's a fight against mindless destruction. Against waste. Against the indifference of nature's destructive side.
And Santiago fights them, even without the harpoon.
He fights with everything he has left. He lashes his knife to an oar. When the knife breaks, he uses the boat's club. When the club is lost, he uses the tiller. It's desperate. Grim.
And ultimately.
Ultimately, it's hopeless. There are too many. They're relentless. The destruction is just total.
So when he finally gets back to the harbor.
It's late at night. And all that's left of his prize, his magnificent marlin, is the skeleton. The head, the tail, and the long spine. That's it. Lashed to the side of his boat, the material prize is gone. Devoured.
That's heartbreaking. What a defeat.
Materially, yes. But the image of his return, it's incredibly powerful. He struggles up the hill to his shack, carrying the heavy mast of his skiff over his shoulder.
Like a cross.
Exactly like a cross. And his hands are wounded from the lines. The Christian imagery is undeniable. The suffering, the sacrifice. It elevates the physical defeat into something else.
A spiritual testament.
Maybe. He collapses onto his bed, into this deep, deep sleep of utter exhaustion. But this is where we get to the core message, the thesis Hemingway seems to be driving at.
Which is?
A man can be destroyed, but not defeated.
Okay, let's dig into that. It sounds like a contradiction. He lost the fish, the sharks destroyed it. How is that not defeat?
Because destruction is external. It's physical loss. Things happen to you. Age, bad luck, sharks. They can take away the material things. They can break your body. But defeat, that's internal. That's giving up your spirit.
So Santiago was destroyed physically, but he never gave up spiritually.
Never. He never stopped fighting with skill and dignity. He never surrendered his integrity during the struggle. He maintained his grace under the most extreme pressure. The sharks took the fish, but they couldn't take his spirit. That's the victory Hemingway values.
And his pride. His orgullo plays into this, doesn't it? It's complicated.
Very complicated. It's that pride that made him go too far out, leading to the confrontation and the loss.
But without that pride, he wouldn't have even tried for greatness.
Exactly. Hemingway isn't condemning pride here, not as arrogance anyway. It's presented as self-respect, determination. It's essential for striving, for reaching beyond the ordinary, even if it carries immense risk. It's what makes the attempt noble in the first place.
And the proof that his struggle wasn't meaningless, despite losing the fish, comes back to Manolin.
Manolin is the key to the resolution, absolutely. When he finds Santiago the next morning, he weeps for the old man's suffering, sees his wounded hands.
But he doesn't see him as defeated.
No. He promises to fish with Santiago again, no matter what. Luck doesn't matter anymore. That promise shows that Santiago's knowledge, his spirit, his way of being that endures, it's passed on. The true legacy isn't the fish, it's the wisdom gained and shared. Manolin confirms Santiago's life has meaning.
And then there's the symbolism layered throughout, like the lions. He keeps dreaming about lions on an African beach.
Yeah, that recurring dream. It's his happy place, his spiritual refuge. The lions seem to represent youth, lost strength, maybe a kind of primal harmony with nature. It's where his mind goes when the present is too harsh. It connects his current frail state to the power he once had and maybe still has deep inside.
And the marlin itself, it's more than just a fish, obviously.
Oh, much more. It's the ultimate challenge, the ideal opponent.
Yep.
Maybe even the unobtainable goal we all strive for in some way. The story suggests the real value isn't necessarily in catching the marlin, but in the courage and dignity you show while trying. The struggle itself is where the meaning lies.
Which makes that final scene with the tourists so pointed.
Ugh, yeah. That final bit of irony. The local fishermen see the skeleton and they know. They're humbled by the sheer size. They understand the epic battle that must have taken place. But the tourists...
They just see a big skeleton and ask what kind of shark it is.
Exactly. They completely miss the point. It just drives home how the true significance of a profound, unseen struggle is often lost on the wider world, which only sees or cares about the obvious material outcome. They can't comprehend the spiritual victory.
It loops back perfectly to that iceberg theory, doesn't it? The real story is beneath the surface, and not everyone can see it.
That sparse style forces you to look deeper. It turns a simple fishing trip into this universal parable about facing loss, about finding meaning in the fight itself.
So the feeling you're left with isn't pity for Santiago.
No, not pity at all. It's more like awe. Inspiration, maybe. His quiet endurance, his refusal to be spiritually broken. It reaffirms something fundamental about human dignity. The spirit can remain unbeaten even when the body is destroyed.
It certainly makes you reconsider what winning and losing really mean.
And it shows us that our worth, our dignity isn't tied to the trophies we collect, but to the grace and courage we bring to life's inevitable struggles. That's how even loss can become a kind of victory. Closing narration. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.